First case for argument is Cage v. McCautry. Mr. Malone.
May it please the court, I'm appearing on behalf of Darrell Cage, who challenges his state conviction. Mr. Cage's habeas petition was denied by the Eastern District in the state of Wisconsin, and Mr. Cage appears before this court pursuant to a grant of a certificate of appealability, where the issue presented is whether or not Mr. Cage was denied a right to an impartial jury by a juror who eventually sat on his case and gave equivocal responses during voir dire.
Mr. Malone, is that issue actually presented by the case as opposed to being presented by our certificate?
That issue is in fact presented by the case, Your Honor.
And how so? Was there an argument made in the Wisconsin courts that trial judges have a duty to remove jurors sua sponte?
That particular issue wasn't presented.
But that's the question that's in our certificate of appealability. And if it was never presented to the Wisconsin courts, then it's just not presented in this case.
Well, I would argue that it is presented in this case because if, in fact, a juror was biased and that juror eventually sat on the case, then a party is entitled to a remedy under the Constitution.
Only if a proper argument has been made to that effect in state court.
Well, the proper argument was, in fact, made to the extent that Mr. Cage argued that his conviction was in violation of the Constitution because there was an improper jury.
The argument he made in state court was ineffective assistance of counsel. It was the argument he made in the district court here. But an ineffective assistance argument is certainly presented, but that's not the argument you're making in your brief. Now, in part, this may be our fault, but if the issue is just not presented by the case, the fact that it's identified in a certificate of appealability doesn't help much.
Well, to the extent, Judge, I would at least refer to the court, for example, to the Hughes case and to the Miller case, in which the analysis there was that if the petitioner did in fact claim that his trial counsel was ineffective because they failed to remove a biased juror, then the petitioner is required to prove that the juror was in fact biased, was actually biased. And that is part of the presentation that Mr. Cage makes in front of this court. And that part of that presentation is the fact that the determination by the Wisconsin State Court that the juror was not biased runs afoul of the principle of jury impartiality that was outlined by United States Supreme Court.
Let me ask the question in a different way. What decision of the Supreme Court would you rely on for the proposition that a trial judge has a duty to remove a juror sua sponte? The cases that your brief cites are all cases where the defense objected, moved to strike the juror. What case establishes the proposition that the trial judge must act even if the defense is content to have a particular person on the jury?
I cannot offer the court a specific case that I would cite.
But you have to have a specific case because 2254D says that unless the state court is inconsistent with a decision of the Supreme Court of the United States, we can't issue a collateral writ. And that's the critical question presented by the line of argument you're making here, whether the judge has to do it without objection.
I understand. How I would respond to this court is that if there is a claim that the juror is biased, then...
There was no claim that the juror was biased in the state court. Right, that's the problem.
What if the defendant's lawyer wants to bias juror on the jury, as this lawyer apparently did. Because you could have a biased person and you could think, this juror is prejudiced against me, but he has other virtues that I think maybe I can swing him around. You know, maybe he's very intelligent or something. Maybe he's also hostile to government. Who knows what? Then there wouldn't be any constitutional violation, would there?
I would argue that there would.
Really? But if the lawyer makes suppose, for example, a juror was the daughter of the prosecutor. That would certainly be grounds for removal for cause. But suppose the defendant's lawyer had reason to think the daughter hated her father and therefore would be a very good juror for his client. Is there anything wrong with that, with allowing a juror to sit in that circumstance?
Well, if the juror in question was asked whether or not, given any relationship to her father, the prosecutor, whether she could set aside whatever that relationship is and decide...
No, the defendant doesn't want her to set aside that relationship. The defense wants to capitalize on that relationship.
I understand. But the problem is that if there isn't the right... to an impartial juror, an impartial jury.
But remember, all these rights are waivable by a defendant. The defendant can waive a right to a jury altogether, or right to a trial altogether. So if the defendant, in his own interest, wants to waive his right to an impartial jury, can he do that?
Well. If the defendant waived his right to a jury, that would be in a public proceeding in which it would be clear that the defendant would know that he has that right and that he chooses to exercise that right. If, on the other hand, that right is not waived in a public proceeding, then there's no clear way to know whether or not the defendant knew that he had a right to an impartial jury and therefore intelligently and knowingly exercised that right.
Well, that's a separate issue, what kind of waivers a lawyer can make and what the defendant has to make personally. But there was a hearing here in which the lawyer testified that this was a tactical judgment on his part. Doesn't seem an indefensible tactical judgment, so...
Well, it does seem indefensible to the extent that the juror never clearly stated that he could be fair. And part of the problem that Mr. Cage raises here before this court is the fact that if a juror had said that I can set aside my position, my impressions or opinions and decide the case based on the evidence, then there would be no claim that could necessarily be made that the juror is impartial. If the juror said, well, I can't be fair, as in the Hughes case, well, then the juror probably should be struck. But if the juror says, I can try isn't sufficient under Irvin for a case to be made that the juror is not impartial, especially given at the outset the juror indicated that they could not be impartial. I reserve my time for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Malone. Ms. Mueller?
May it please the court, I'm Assistant Attorney General Marguerite Mueller, representing the respondent, Gary McCautry. I think the court has hit the nail on the head in saying that this case does not really present the issue that was stated in the Certificate of Appealability. The case was briefed as an issue of ineffective assistance of trial counsel in failing to either move to strike juror Wirth for cause or in failing to exercise a peremptory challenge to get juror Wirth off of the jury that decided Mr. Cage's guilt. And I think if you look at the report of Magistrate Goodstein, who conducted the evidentiary hearing, he concluded at page 8, Mr. Cage was not deprived of the effective assistance of counsel during the voir dire stage of his trial, which is the only issue under consideration on his petition. And Judge Curran, in his decision and order of March of 2001, specifically adopted the findings of fact and conclusions of law that were reached by Magistrate Goodstein. So the issue, as the respondent conceives it, is whether or not the state court's decision that Mr. Cage was not deprived of the effective assistance of counsel is either contrary to or an unreasonable application of Strickland versus Washington. And I think it's beyond argument that it was not either contrary to or an unreasonable application of Strickland, because first of all, the Court of Appeals did not rely on a case other than Strickland, and second of all, if you look at the testimony of trial counsel Stan Nelson at the evidentiary hearing, it was apparent that he was not guilty of deficient performance in failing to strike juror Wirth from the panel because he had a strategic reason for wanting juror Wirth to remain on Cage's jury. In fact, he had two different strategies, one of which was juror Wirth's familiarity with the effects of cocaine abuse. Juror Wirth had stated that he was familiar with cocaine abuse because in a previous job, two co-workers had to be let go because they had engaged in drug abuse. And Mr. Nelson thought this was actually beneficial because the only defense at Cage's murder trial was whether voluntary intoxication by cocaine would knock the charge of intentional first-degree homicide down to first-degree reckless homicide. And Attorney Nelson testified at the evidentiary hearing that he wanted somebody who was aware of the effects that drug use could have on a person's behavior. He did not want somebody who was so naive that they would be put off totally by the fact that Mr. Cage had ingested cocaine on the day that he killed the victim. So that was one of the strategic reasons. The other was he believed that juror Wirth was not really sincere in talking about being biased or partial at the beginning of the voir dire, and that it was really a feeble attempt to get off the jury, that he simply did not want to do his civic duty. And Attorney Nelson believed that this actually would benefit his client because by remaining on the jury, the juror Wirth would be more likely to take it out against the trial judge or the prosecutor. So he had these two reasons, the primary one being the fact that juror Wirth was exposed to cocaine abuse in the workplace. He thought he would be a good juror from the defense standpoint. And Magistrate Goodstein found that this was not deficient performance, that these were reasonable decisions that a defense attorney could make. So in that respect, there is no way that the Court of Appeals determination that Cage was given the effective assistance of counsel was an unreasonable application of Strickland. And that is what the respondent asserts Mr. Cage must show this court. Alternatively, even if you did characterize the issue presented as the one formulated in the Certificate of Appealability, the respondent does not believe that Cage has demonstrated that the state court's decision was an unreasonable application of Irvin versus Dowd. That case is extremely different because there you have the petitioner's counsel repeatedly asking the court for a change of venue because of the inability to seat an impartial jury. The jury in that case had 8 of 12 members who admitted before hearing any testimony.
Yeah, I mean, clearly that's a different case. You don't have to.
Correct. If there are no further questions, the respondent would rely on the brief that was submitted to this court.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Fowler.
Thank you.
Mr. Malone, how much time does he have? 1 minute?
In response, I would note that the argument presented by the state this morning with respect to the legitimacy of the issue presented through the certificate of appealability is not the argument that the state presented at the time that there was an application for that certificate of appealability. And I think that that's significant and that's important. Furthermore, the state insisting that the argument here is whether or not there was a unreasonable application based on the Strickland standard, in its brief, cites Miller. And I just want to emphasize that the court in Miller found that there was not ineffective assistance, in large part due to the fact that the Miller court found that there wasn't a biased juror. And the reason that the Miller court found that there wasn't a biased juror was because the juror in Miller stated that although she would feel uncomfortable serving on the jury because she had some knowledge of the case from the mother of the victim, that juror still said that she could be fair. That's not the case here. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Mullen. You were appointed, were you not? And we thank you for accepting the appointment.